From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I think there's no doubt that they had extensive connections to all sorts of different white hate groups in the United States and some abroad, in the case of the German neo-Nazi Strassmeyer again. McVeigh had links to the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. They both were reading the newspapers put out by the Liberty Lobby, a pro-fascist type of organization in the U.S. But it's one thing to say that these individuals had extensive links to the subterranean, crazed white racialist fringe. It's another thing to say definitively that others were assisting them when McVeigh undertook the bombing.
The Terry Nichols trial begins, and we look at the demise of National Citizen Action. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court refused to review California's affirmative action ban. While setting no precedent, the court's rejection of a challenge to the 1996 ballot initiative is likely to galvanize the movement to pass similar legislation in other states and cities. If such efforts are successful, justices are almost certain to be asked to revisit the issue. The law, which passed as Proposition 209, bars race and gender preferences in government hiring, education, and contracting. And on this election day in Houston, voters will be considering the son of Prop 209 bill, a bill that would also end affirmative action in Houston. Despite an Iraqi threat to shoot down U.S. spy planes, the United Nations says its international disarmament experts will proceed with arms inspections and surveillance flights. Iraq reacted today by turning back U.N. weapons inspectors for a second day, saying it would not grant access to any teams that included Americans. According to the Washington Post, the CIA and the White House have formally dropped their claim that a seismic disturbance in the vicinity of a Russian nuclear test site in the Arctic Circle may have been caused by a nuclear explosion, ending a disagreement within the government over whether Russia had illicitly tested a nuclear weapon August 16th. This according to senior officials. The administration's turnabout came after four independent experts who were appointed by CIA Director George Tenet to review the agency's controversial analysis of the seismic event concluded in a brief classified report to him last week that the disturbance almost certainly was not caused by a nuclear explosion. The CIA had initially reported to the White House within a few days of the event that it was likely caused by an explosion at the test site, sowing wide alarm and prompting the administration to register a stiff complaint in Moscow. But Tenet accepted the panel's conclusion last week and distributed the expert's report to senior policymakers and to selected members of Congress. On the heels of President Clinton's decision to let China buy U.S. nuclear power reactors, a coalition of nuclear watchdogs and environmentalists say they have urged Beijing to reject the goods. In a letter to Chinese President Jiang Zemin, groups including the Sierra Club, Public Citizen, and Nuclear Information Resource Service urge him to meet energy experts to consider cleaner and less costly alternatives for China. U.S. companies seeking to sell reactors to China said they offered an environmentally cleaner alternative to dirty coal-fired power plants being used to drive the country's industrial boom. But the anti-nuclear group said U.S. investors do not consider nuclear power a cost-effective way to produce electricity and warned China is committing itself to an expensive, dangerous, and unsustainable energy course. A Honduran bishop on Monday accused the country's army of murdering a radical American priest who disappeared in the 1980s. James Carney, a U.S. citizen, vanished shortly after entering southern Honduras in 1983 with about 100 guerrillas from neighboring Nicaragua. This according to Luis Santos, the bishop at a Santa Rosa de Copan in western Honduras. Honduras's army has said Carney, whose body was never found, died in combat. But Santos said yesterday the American priest was captured alive by Honduran anti-insurgency troops. Santos said he obtained the information that Carney was tortured and mutilated from recently declassified Central Intelligence Agency documents. The Honduran army was largely trained by the Central Intelligence Agency. Five of Carney's family members and colleagues staged a brief hunger strike last week at the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa to pressure Washington to make public all its files on the case. Carney is listed as one of hundreds of people who officials say disappeared during the army's sweep against a small insurgency in the 1980s in Honduras. Nigeria's Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, known as MOSAP, plans a week of rallies and other events to mark the 1995 hanging of author Ken Sarawiwa and eight other activists. The newspaper said activities in the oil-rich southeastern region would culminate in remembrance services on November 10th, the second anniversary of the executions, which brought worldwide commendation of the military government of General Sani Abacha. Precise details of the program were not given. Here in this country, in Mobile, Alabama, a jury convicted three white youths of conspiring to burn a rural black church, but acquitted them in the first trial involving a new federal racial hatred law. Alan Odom, Brandy Boone, and John Kenneth Cumby were convicted yesterday on a conspiracy count in the June 30th torching that destroyed St. Joe Baptist Church, a 21-member church in the Little River community. Prosecutors said they filed the racial hatred counts because Boone attended a Ku Klux Klan rally 2 days earlier. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The National Office of Citizen Action, one of the most effective grassroots organizations on the left, last week became the first victim of political and union fundraising investigations that have already damaged the Democratic National Committee and the reform wing of organized labor. The Republican Party and conservative groups have not emerged unscathed. The inquiries have raised significant questions concerning the fundraising scandals and relationships between the GOP and such organizations as American for Tax Reform, Triad Management, and the American Defense Institute. In addition, a federal grand jury has been investigating a $1.6 million loan arranged in 1994 by then-Republican National Committee Chair Haley Barbour from Hong Kong businessman Ambrose Young to National Policy Forum, a GOP think tank founded by Barbour. But for a generation of grassroots advocates, the advocacy group Citizen Action had become a liberal refuge in the late 1970s as the civil rights and anti-war movements waned and conservatism gained strength in American politics. And with last week's closing of the National Office of Citizen Action, it has raised many questions about the direction that liberal groups have gone. Today, we're joined by the executive director of Ohio Citizen Action. Now, this is a group in Ohio which seceded from the national organization 1 year ago. We're joined by the executive director, Sandy Buchanan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, why don't we start off with what's happened to the national organization and why it was that you left the national organization a year ago?
Well, I think it's fair to say that what happened was what happens with many Washington-based operations. National Citizen Action was created in 1979 by a group of state affiliates, including ourselves, who wanted to work together on national issues. And what happened over time was the Washington office kind of took on a life of its own and began to do things that certainly, in our view, were not coordinated and not even in line with some of the policies of the state organizations. So we disaffiliated a year ago primarily over disagreements about funding sources. They had thought it was okay to take money from some tobacco interests and also nuclear utilities, which were two interests that we felt were completely inappropriate for an organization like ours to be funded by. And after a number of months of internal debate and a unanimous vote by our board, we disaffiliated.
But could you be more specific about the money that National Citizen Action was taking? You mentioned the nuclear industry.
That's right. They received funding. It was quite controversial within the organization because technically the donor was anonymous, but it was very clear from the things that the donor was asking the organization to do and from some comments that were made by the staff of the national organization that the donor was a nuclear utility. And we never knew exactly which one, but what we noticed was the organization suddenly was taking positions on electric issues that were contrary to the positions, for example, of our organization and of Citizens Action of Indiana, which also disaffiliated. You know, we've spent many, many years opposing the boondoggle of nuclear power in Ohio, as some of the other affiliates, and we just thought it was unconscionable.
But what do you mean they weren't telling you specifically who the money was from? Weren't you part of the organization?
Well, that was one of the problems. We were an affiliate of the organization, but we were not part of the decisions about whether to take money. And when we learned after the fact that it had occurred, we and the Indiana group asked that the money be returned, but that never happened.
Now, that actually is not what is getting the National Office of Citizen Action in so much trouble. People like Ira Arluck, who is the executive director, or I should say was. What's getting them in serious trouble, now there have not been indictments handed down, and apparently Ira Arluck is cooperating with federal investigators on this, but it's the whole issue of the very close relationship between Citizen Action, the Teamsters, and the Democratic National Committee. Can you explain that relationship?
Well, we were not a part of any of these things that went on. We learned about this, as did most people, I think, reading about it in the newspaper this June. So the only information we have is actually what we've read in the media, which has detailed ways in which money was taken from the Teamsters through Citizen Action and back to the Kerry campaign, as part of, you know, the things that we've been reading about where three campaign officials pled guilty earlier this year.
But what was Citizen Action doing in such a close relationship with the Democratic National Committee in particular? And, of course, we can't avoid the fact that Citizen Action has become known for dealing with the issue of campaign finance abuse and changing campaign finance laws.
Well, I think that's one of the problems they certainly faced. It's very difficult to talk about the need for cleaning up elections and you know, not having special interest money influence politicians, and then at the same time to say that you yourself could not be influenced by that money. And that was one of the reasons why we disaffiliated. We felt that it is true that money influences an organization's stance and behavior, and that therefore we thought there are certain places where you shouldn't take money. I mean, we had some differences with the whole campaign that was run last year on the elections. Again, we felt that things were getting a little too partisan.
Hmm. I thought there's a very interesting piece in the Washington Post two Sundays ago, Mainstream Politics Linked to Teamsters May Stunt Liberal Activist Group. And it says Citizens Action's leaders acknowledge the group's successful alliance with organized labor may have done more long-term harm than good. The group's entangled in a scandal involving illegal contributions to Teamsters President Ron Kerry that could have dire implications for the organization's future. This was before it closed its national office last week. It said as this Teamsters scandal has mushroomed, it's drawn in top officials of the AFL-CIO, Democratic National Committee, and a variety of unions and liberal activist group. Many in organized labor worry that the allegations of an elaborate money laundering scheme to help Ron Kerry win re-election as Teamsters head will spell the end of the union reform movement. It also could damage a fragile alliance that has developed in recent years between labor and left-leaning outside political groups. Federal prosecutors in New York are examining whether Citizen Action served as a money conduit for illegal contributions to the 96 re-election of Kerry. In return for increased union contributions, a spokesperson for Citizen Action said no one in the organization knowingly participated in any illegal activities. And it goes on to say, in Kerry's first term as president, the Teamsters' contributions to Citizen Action averaged little more than $11,000 a year. But late in 96, just 2 weeks before the November 5th federal elections, the Teamsters donated $475,000 to the group. Prosecutors claim the Teamsters gave another $150,000 last year to the AFL-CIO, funds earmarked for Citizen Action as part of a money swap. The AFL gave Citizen Action $45,000 in 95. A year later, it gave $1.5 million. Now, Kerry and officials of the AFL-CIO have said they have no knowledge of any illegal financing scheme. But then it goes on to talk about the close relationship, very close relationship, between the heads of Citizen Action and the other groups. For example, you have Karen Nussbaum, head of the new women's department at the AFL-CIO and the founder of the Union 9 to 5, married to Ira Arluck, who is the head of Citizen Action. Mike Podharzer, a former national leader of Citizen Action and husband of EPA Administrator Carol Browner, recently joined the AFL-CIO's political affairs department. Stephen Rosenfield began his career as a community organizer, then went to work for the Communication Workers of America. He was labor liaison at the Democratic National Committee and then at the Labor Department before Sweeney chose him to be political political affairs director of the AFL. Rosenthal's wife helped found Citizen Action of New Jersey. Heather Booth was a founder of Citizen Action and the Midwest Academy, which trains organizers for community groups and liberal lobbies. Last year, she worked for the Democratic National Committee under the co-chairmanship of Senator Christopher Dodd. And in 65, her future husband, Paul Booth, was National Secretary of Students for Democratic Action. And it goes on from there. Today, Paul Booth is director of organizing for AFSCME, the nation's largest public sector union, and a top advisor to its president. Neither of the Booths have been implicated in the current scandal. Now, none of this, I mean, those relationships I read, implicates anyone. But it does show how close the relationship is between Citizens Action, not to mention, by the way, the person who was the overseer in the case of looking at the Ron Carey campaign, married to a key person in the new party.
That's right.
So what do you make of all of these relationships? Or am I just really describing, people who are together because of, this is in no suggestion illegality. It's just these are the circles people travel in.
Right. I don't think there's a lot you can make of, the fact that people have personal relationships. I'm sure you'd find that in all kinds of organizations around the country. I think the key question to us, again, was accountability and a decision-making process that would try to keep things from happening that shouldn't happen. And, that accountability needs to exist no matter who you're dealing with.
Well, now, Sandy Buchanan, as executive director of Ohio Citizen Action, which seceded from National Citizen Action a year ago, what are you doing? Are you able to survive? How do you get your funding? And how large is Ohio Citizen Action?
Ohio Citizen Action has 350,000 members statewide, which are all recruited through our door-to-door canvas program, which is also our primary source of funding. We're doing fine. And, in fact, our relationship with Citizen Action, we were a dues-paying affiliate, but we always had an independent board and finances, as do several of the other groups that remained affiliated and those that didn't. So we're doing fine. I think it's very important to us to be grassroots-based, to work with people door-to-door. And I think that was a distinction. That was something that National Citizen Action had decided not to do anymore. And although it's sad when you see something like a Washington office close, to us, Citizen Action, with a small C and a small A, was never really, a Washington-based lobbying operation. The importance are the groups out there around the country, some of which have Citizen Action in their name and some of which don't, that are thriving, working out in the grassroots, working with Canvas programs, and there's a lot of great stuff going on out there.
Doesn't this also point to a larger problem and issue that various groups are grappling with, and that is whether to be grassroots, whether to go the canvassing route, or whether to, just set up shop inside Washington and put your resources there? I was just looking at the upcoming piece of John Judis in The American Prospect that comes out of Massachusetts, where he looks at both Citizen Action and Greenpeace, which has laid off most of its staff, closed all of its field offices, and is just focusing on lobbying in Washington.
I think it depends on what kind of an organization you want to be. I mean, obviously, our organization or the Indiana group and some others decided that, this is our character. This is us. It's working with people door-to-door in the communities on local campaigns. And without that, there would be no point in our existing. Greenpeace, from my understanding, is still going to be doing their direct actions and a lot of things like that. They really came to the conclusion that they're not running local campaigns, and therefore it's, you don't run a canvas if you're not running local campaigns. So I think it's very important for an organization to decide what its focus is, what its character is, and then, stick true to that.
Hmm. Do you think foundations led National Citizen Action astray, or was this other complicated relationship with the Teamsters and the Democratic National Committee?
Oh, I don't think you can lay it at the feet of foundations or, frankly, at the other complicated relationship. I think there were decisions that were made by a leadership and a board about how the organization was going to operate and what it was acceptable to do to keep open. And I really think that what happened with the closing of the National was the inevitable result of what had gone on for quite a while before. I mean, certainly the Teamsters situation may have accelerated the process, but there were already, a great deal of internal problems.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Sally Buchanan. If you'd like to give out the number, the contact, the if you have an email address or website of Ohio Citizen Action, which, yes, has remained strong as National Citizen Action has gone down.
Ohio Citizen Action can be reached at 216-861-5200, or the web address would be ohiocitizen.org.
That's www.ohiocitizen.org.
That's right.
Or 216-861-5200. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll take a look at the Oklahoma City bombing trial number 2, the case of Terry Nichols. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Terry Nichols worked side by side with Timothy McVeigh to prepare the bomb that destroyed the Oklahoma City Federal Building. This, according to prosecutors yesterday, as they opened their case against Terry Nichols before a federal court jury in Denver. But Mr. Nichols' lawyer said his client had nothing to do with the bomb plot and had merely been trapped by the deceit of his friend McVeigh and by a web of misleading circumstantial evidence. Larry Mackey, the lead prosecutor, told jurors that the deceit was all on the part of Nichols. When the bomb went off at 9:02 a.m. on April 19, 1995, killing 168 people, Terry Nichols was at home in Canvas. Mr. Mackey said home and at a very safe distance. Terry Nichols had planned it just that way, Mackey said. While Mackey did not accuse Nichols of joining McVeigh on his trip to Oklahoma City to detonate the bomb, he said Nichols had been actively involved in the plotting of the attack and the building of the bomb. McVeigh was convicted on identical charges of murder and conspiracy by a jury in June and sentenced to death by Judge Richard Match of Federal District Court, who's also presiding over this trial. The case outlined by Mackey is broader than the case against McVeigh and includes previously undisclosed evidence. Prosecutors are expected to present evidence about the bomb's construction and about a robbery in Arkansas that they say helped finance the plot. Another new accusation is that McVeigh and Nichols got together shortly after McVeigh arrived in Kansas on April 13th, 6 days before the bombing. In McVeigh's trial, prosecutors had only presented telephone records that they said showed the two men had talked in the days before the bombing. When Nichols was first interviewed by agents for the FBI on April 21st, 2 days after the bombing, Mackey said, he told them he had not heard from McVeigh for months before receiving a phone call from him on April 16th, which was Easter Sunday. Nichols, who was living in Washington, in Hermington, a small town south of Fort Riley, where the two men had been stationed together in the Army, told the FBI he'd written his old friend a letter at his address in Kingman, Arizona, months earlier. In it, he asked him to pick up a TV set from Nichols' former wife, who was living in Las Vegas, Nevada, a short distance from Kingman, and bring it to Kansas the next time he came. On Easter, Nichols said McVeigh called from Oklahoma City to say he had the TV, but his car had broken down. Nichols said he went there to pick him up. Today, and through this trial, Mackey says the government will disprove Nichols' story that he did not see McVeigh before Easter by producing a receipt for an oil filter purchased by McVeigh at a Walmart in Arkansas City, Kansas, near the Oklahoma state line, shortly before 6 on Thursday, April 13th. McVeigh had checked out of his Kingman motel room and day before driving hard, and his 1983 Pontiac station wagon was having engine trouble by the time he got to Kansas. On the following day, however, when McVeigh arrived at a Firestone store in Junction City, Kansas, Mackey said, smoke was pouring out of the engine, and McVeigh exchanged his ruined car and $250 for a 1977 Mercury Marquis purchased from the manager of the store. McVeigh then had no use for the new oil filter, Mackey said, and Nichols tried to return it to a local Walmart on Saturday, April 15th. The receipt was found in Nichols' wallet. On it were two fingerprints, one from Nichols and one from Mr. McVeigh. Well, today we're going to take an interesting journey. We're going to start off by looking at the Oklahoma City bombing. And then we're going to look at neo-Nazis and neo-fascists from Germany to Italy to Russia. It's a circuitous route, but an interesting one. We're joined by Martin Lee. He's written extensively for Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, San Francisco Chronicle, Los Angeles Times. And he has a new book, which is called The Beast Reawakens, Millions Died to End Fascism. It survived to make a comeback. This is the story of how and why. Why don't we begin, Martin Lee, by talking about the trial of Terry Nichols and before that, Timothy McVeigh.
There are well-documented connections now between Timothy McVeigh and the German neo-Nazis seen through a particular character named Andreas Strassmeier. He was a German neo-Nazi, an Army veteran in his mid-30s. He was living in the United States at an armed white supremacist encampment called Elohim City. This is in the backwoods of Oklahoma City. And this German neo-Nazi Strassmeier was in charge of security at this white supremacist compound. And he was also leading paramilitary training, teaching people how to, you know, use techniques of night combat and so forth and so on. Well, shortly before the Oklahoma City bombing, McVeigh called Elohim City. This has been documented. According to the leaders of the Elohim City compound, he asked to speak to Strassmeier. Now, both Strassmeier and McVeigh are on the record having admitted that they knew each other. They had met each other many months before at a gun show in Tulsa. They traded addresses, swapped some weapons, so forth and so on. So there is this documented link between McVeigh and this German neo-Nazi. What happened is that Elohim City was penetrated by U.S. government informants. There was a woman named Carol Howe who worked for the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms Unit of the Treasury Department. And she was reporting on what she saw going on there. And allegedly, at least this is what she is purported to have told her ATF handlers, and it has been acknowledged by the ATF that she was a paid informant. She heard people, including Strassmeier, making frequent threats against the U.S. government, threatening to blow up buildings, threatening to blow up federal buildings in Oklahoma even. And this is, again, now months before the Oklahoma City bombing. There were Ku Klux Klan leaders hanging out this place. I mean, this is a real extreme, hardcore situation in Elohim City. Certain people in the militia movement, and even some white supremacists these days, have seized upon this to contend that the government knew beforehand that the Oklahoma City attack was going to occur, because Carol Howe apparently was telling them that something was afoot. But the evidence that's been presented thus far by several investigations, and not only is the Nichols trial now happening, but there is a grand jury investigation in Oklahoma City looking into these allegations. There's also a wrongful death petition that's been filed by Johnny Cochran, O.J. Simpson's attorney, among others, on behalf of the surviving kin of the Oklahoma City bomb victims. And those two investigations, the grand jury investigation, the wrongful death suit, are looking into specifically allegations of a wider plot involving not just McVeigh and possibly Nichols, but others at Elohim City, and also the possibility that the government knew beforehand but didn't take appropriate actions to thwart this bomb plot. But on the basis of the evidence, which I've looked at very, very closely, it does not warrant leaping to those conclusions that the government actually knew and they just didn't do anything. It's a rather grotesque notion. The U.S. government, you know, there's lots to criticize, but that would be a tough one for a lot of people to swallow. Because I think what you have to realize at a place like Elohim City, these are fanatic individuals who hate the United States government because they consider them run by race traitors or the Zionist occupation conspiracy or whatever they might call it. And they're constantly making threats against the government. And here you have this woman, Carol Howe, a teenager who is a former Oklahoma City beauty queen. She's quite attractive. She has a tattoo of a swastika on her arm. And all these macho gun nuts in Elohim City are trying to pick up on her and impress her. Now, if you're trying to impress somebody, and you're a Nazi who's drunk on a sixth beer that day, what do? You boast about how you're going to hit a government target, how you blow up a building, and the next guy says, I'm going to blow up a bigger building, and the next one, you know, they're constantly talking like this. There's probably not a day went by in the last 10 years that someone in Elohim City wasn't talking about a plot or taking action against the government. Now, whether in fact these threats had any bearing on what McVeigh did is not at all clear. Carol Howe alleges that McVeigh did come through Elohim City and he stopped there for a while. But even if he did, there still is no evidence that, you know, what was being talked about had a direct bearing on what he ended up doing. But the ultra-right has seized upon this as a part of their fanatical anti-government, you know, conspiracies to allege that it wasn't the neo-Nazis who were responsible, it wasn't the militias, but it was the government itself.
Is there anything valid to say about Terry Nichols or Timothy McVeigh's connection to international fascist groups?
I think there's no doubt that they had extensive connections to all sorts of different different white hate groups in the United States and some abroad, in the case of the German neo-Nazi Strassmeyer again. McVeigh had links to the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. They both were reading the newspapers put out by the Liberty Lobby, a pro-fascist type of organization in the U.S. But it's one thing to say that these individuals had extensive links to the subterranean or crazed white racialist fringe. It's another thing to say definitively that others were assisting them when McVeigh undertook the bombing. You can't necessarily make that leap. Unfortunately, the way the prosecution conducted the prosecution went after McVeigh, they looked, strictly speaking, at the question of whether he's guilty or not. I guess that's the job of the prosecution to do that. They want to simplify the issues, as they'll try to do again in the Nichols trial as well, to solely whether he was guilty of the bombing or not. They're not interested in necessarily bringing in all their connections to German neo-Nazis and American neo-Nazis. That isn't necessarily relevant to the question of his guilt or innocence. So because the judge sided with the prosecution in the McVeigh case and may well in the Nichols case, the attempt on the part of the defense to bring in these other connections to muddle the issue, to raise doubts in the jury's mind, was denied by the judge, probably rightfully so in terms of the legal case in and of itself. But unfortunately, that encouraged those in the far right who seize upon this as an example of, again, the government covering up all these links because they want to say that it was the government ultimately behind the bombing, again, which I think is far off the mark. It's the neo-Nazis who were responsible for this bombing, McVeigh and perhaps some others, but certainly that small cell.
In this country, you also talk about the history of U.S. Army intelligence recruitment of Ku Klux Klan members to spy on Dr. Martin Luther King and other civil rights activists. How does that tie into your whole theory about the growth of fascism today?
Well, after World War II, fascism and fascists were kept alive in some sense, even though they're on the fringes politically, by virtue of the relationships they were able to establish with intelligence agencies, particularly U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA and the German Nazis worked for the CIA after the war, spying against the Soviet Union. And in the domestic arena in the United States, white hate groups at different times, even though they denounced the U.S. government, they consider it run by race traitors or this kind of cockamamie nonsense, still on certain occasions, they formed alliances with U.S. intelligence agencies. And in the late 1960s, when Dr. Martin Luther King began to denounce U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, U.S. military intelligence got very upset, and they used certain Klan groups in Alabama to spy on civil rights protesters and to spy on King. So here is an instance when the Ku Klux Klan served the interests of U.S. military intelligence. There were also several instances documented where the FBI had infiltrated Ku Klux Klan groups in order presumably to keep a watch on what was going on. But in fact, certain leaders of these groups who were informing for the FBI were also at the same time provoking others to violent acts against African-American churches and civil rights activists. Churches were burned down. People were killed as a result of the provocations by the FBI informants themselves. And instead of bringing these people to book, the FBI told them to hide their affiliations with the FBI, obviously. They covered for their own informants, and guilty people were never brought to justice as a result.
But you see no parallels between that in the 1960s and, for example, Timothy McVeigh today, the possibility that he could have been working for the U.S. government, or you think that's very far-fetched?
No, I think Timmy McVeigh was not working for the U.S. government. Certain people within Elohim City scene, such as Carol Howe, and there were probably other informants, were working for the U.S. government. But then it raises the question of where did the ultimate loyalties lay? I have interviewed some leaders of the scene, and including people who have functioned as informants for the U.S. government. And some of these people, even though they were functioning as informants and were publicly identified as such, having been having penetrated the American Nazi Party or Ku Klux Klan groups, they were still accepted by their white racialist brothers because they claim that some of these people were really still working for the white hate scene and were really spying on the government for that. You know, so it's, sometimes it's hard to ferret out really who's working for who, where the ultimate loyalties lay. The important thing is that to keep in mind is that there's no scruples here, that the government intelligence agents will use these groups when it suits their ends, and these white hate groups will use the government when it suits its own ends.
We are talking to Martin Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, looking at the growth of fascism. Who would you say are the key people that are responsible for the growth of fascism in Europe?
Well, when you look at Europe, and you look at the mass-based neo-fascist parties, that's one aspect of the neo-fascists. I'm sure you've got your skinheads, and they're brutalizing people, and that shouldn't be underestimated, but I don't see the skinheads necessarily as politically dangerous, though they're active in every country in Europe, Eastern and Western Europe. But the key leaders in France are Jean-Marie Le Pen, head of the National Front. In Vlaams, in Belgium, there's Vlaams Bloc, the Flemish militant party that... some of the key leaders there are Javier Broussard, who is the propaganda chief for Vlaams Bloc. And here, again, is a mass-based political party that's the leading political party now in Antwerp, the second biggest city in Belgium. When you look at Javier Broussard's career, you find that he was the leader of a Flemish terrorist organization, a neo-fascist terrorist organization called the VMO, the Vlaams Militant Order, which was actually banned by the Belgian government a few years back. And he himself, Broussard, was the editor of a Holocaust denial journal. And then he sort of takes off those clothes and, you know, puts on nattier dress and a suit and tie, and he becomes the propaganda chief for a party that takes off in a major way in Belgium and now is a serious force in that country. I mean, that underscores how these mass-based parties have a very hardcore, you know, central thrust to them. So it's these kinds of individuals. Even in Norway, shockingly enough, in the recent election there in September of 97, they gained over 15% of the vote. The Progress Party, which is the neo-fascist party there, they're, again, familiar anti-immigrant themes. There were also some other issues they stressed that were unique to the situation in Norway. But when you look at the Progress Party, you find hardcore neo-Nazi militants and activists who have gravitated toward that party and playing a major role. So this is a disturbing trend we're finding, and it is not clear how far it's going to go. But we're talking about a major force affecting all of Europe.
What about trends to counter the growth of fascism in Europe and here? Grassroots groups.
They exist in Europe. They exist in the United States. There is mass-based anti-racist movements. They're saddled with their own problems, and I think one of the chief ones are, you know, they're aiming at a different target from the old type of racism. When you hear someone like a David Duke, for example, used to wear the swastika on the arm, and then he runs for governor of Louisiana on the Republican ticket, and he wins a majority of the white vote in a losing effort in 1991. Well, what was Duke saying at the time, and what does he continue to say? He says things like, white people should be proud of their heritage. Black people should be proud of theirs. Now, on the surface, there's nothing particularly objectionable to that statement. But when it's David Duke saying it, you know, it ought to raise a flag. And what has David Duke been doing recently? He's going around giving speeches before the National Alliance, a neo-Nazi group in the United States whose leader, William Pierce, wrote the Turner Diaries, this novel that inspired Timothy McVeigh to undertake the Oklahoma City bombing. So he's back where he belongs, where he always was, really, Duke, at the heart of the neo-Nazi scene. But it became much more difficult to sort of recognize his extremism when he used that more tolerant-sounding, mainstream type of vocabulary, when he was actually... What comes down to is that the kind of racism that Duke was espousing when he says blacks and whites should all be proud of their heritage was a kind of racism that affirmed the identity of African Americans on some level, rather than your typical white supremacist racism that would ordinarily deny the dignity of another person, another human being. The kind of racism we see today, in some sense, affirms the identity of another person. And that's what makes it so tricky and difficult on some level to fight and struggle against.
We're talking to Martin Lee. He is the author of The Beast Reawakens, Millions Died to End Fascism. It survived to mount a comeback. This is the story of how and why. And by the way, if you'd like to order a cassette copy of today or any day's show of Democracy Now!, you can call the Pacific Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back with Martin Lee here on Democracy Now! In a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with Martin Lee, journalist who's written the book The Beast Reawakens, Millions Died to End Fascism, It Survived to Mount a Comeback. This is the story of how and why as we switch from what happens here in this country to Europe. You pointed out to me, Martin, that just a couple weeks ago, author Günter Grass was criticized or attacked in Germany.
Well, Günter Grass is a world-renowned writer, probably Germany's foremost novelist since the end of World War II. And he was asked to give a keynote speech as a part of an award ceremony at the Frankfurt Book Fair. This is the most important international book fair. And they were giving an award to a Kurdish writer named Yasser Kemal. Günter Grass, in his speech, condemned what he described as latent German hate of foreigners. And he said that Germans, and I'm quoting now directly from his speech, have all become a passive witnesses once again to barbarism, this time barbarism backed by democracy. And what he was referring to was the use of German weapons by the Kurdish government to fight a war of extermination. That's, again, a phrase he used, war of extermination against Turkish Kurds. And he also denounced Germany's refusal to grant political asylum to those Kurds who wanted to flee from Turkey and go to Germany where they could be safer. And what Grass was really upset about, again, what he described as latent German hatred of foreigners, which he said was translated into bureaucratically coded deportation policies of the Interior Ministry of Germany, which finds its echoes in the columns of the extreme right. And when he made these denunciations, it triggered a very vicious response of the leading politicians in Germany who had said basically that they don't have to put up with this kind of statements from Grass anymore. And that in turn prompted a group of skinheads to attempt to physically attack him. That was reported in the by Agence France-Presse, although the German press agency denied that there was any attempt to attack him in wake of his comments.
Why is immigration such a key issue for far-right wingers, for neo-fascists?
Well, it is a key issue. It's the issue that neo-fascist demagogues in Europe have been using to gain support for mass-based political parties, not only in Germany, but in France, Austria, Italy, Belgium, and Norway recently as well. I think immigration is key for two reasons. First is economic. It really, more than anything, embodies the most visible sign of the major shifts in the global economy as a result of the globalization that has accelerated since the end of the Cold War, because people can move now from country to country, from Eastern Europe, from Russia. There has been a mass exodus from these countries that are hard hit with economic problems, also from the Third World, toward the more prosperous Western European countries, including Germany. So neo-fascist demagogues have been equating job loss or joblessness with the presence of immigrants in a very deceptive and manipulative way. But while economic globalization is obviously economically driven by major corporations, it also has very significant cultural impact in these countries. And where so it's not just economic here. Politicians like Jean-Marie Le Pen, the leader of the National Front in France, will say that in order to protect protect French cultural identity, the unique traditions of France as a nation. They have to kick all the foreigners out, send the Arabs back to North Africa, and so forth and so on. So it's under the guise of protecting cultural identity as well as the questions of economic security and anxieties that have been accentuated by these massive economic changes. That this is why immigration is such a key issue.
And Le Pen's party in France, an ultra-right-wing party.
I would call it a neo-fascist party. When you look at Le Pen's roots, he founded the National Front in 1972 at a time when he was selling recordings of Hitler's speeches. It took him a while for that party to move from the fringes to the mainstream, but now it is a major political force in France.
Let's define some terms. When you say neo-fascist, what do you mean?
Well, you know, it's tricky because we don't mean necessarily groups and individuals that overtly look back to Hitler's regime or Mussolini's regime, because the more astute fascist strategists like Le Pen realize that if they were to flaunt that affiliation, it would make it very difficult for them to attract voters. So the more astute strategists have cloaked their message in a new vocabulary. They've tried to mainstream their message by emphasizing themes like immigration and economic insecurity, but they don't do it in the way we normally associate with the white racist. Le Pen will not say whites are superior, Arabs are inferior, or others are inferior, therefore kick them out. What he will say, he will cloak his racism under the guise, almost like a tolerance or pluralism. He will say, we care so much about the unique traditions of Arabs from North Africa and their cultural identity. We want to affirm their identity, so therefore let's kick them out, send them back to Africa, because this way we can preserve the French identity and the Arab identity. It's a different kind of racism, one that's a little more subtle and a more difficult target to hit if you're an anti-racist.
Do you see parallels here in this country?
Oh, very definitely. You can look at Pat Buchanan's campaign when he was striving for the Republican nomination in 1992 and 96 for president. Leaders of the National Front in France, for example, when they read Buchanan's program and platform, they said, this is ours identically. He is a brother to us. He is one of us. And again, Buchanan won't say he's a fascist. That won't play well in Peoria or anywhere else in this country. But when you look at the way he analyzes social and economic problems, you find that kind of classic fascist denunciation of the so-called welfare cheat, or the poor mooching the little guy from below, and then the big corporations from above, and that kind of squeeze of the middle class being trapped by the poor on the one side and the big business on the other. That's a kind of classic fascist analysis. It differs from progressive analysis, obviously.
Martin Lee, I was looking at a piece you did, an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times, where you talk about an Italian wine company recently sparking an uproar when it introduced a new brand with a picture of Adolf Hitler on its label, the same company that produces bottles of wine featuring Benito Mussolini's picture. What's this all about?
Well, it's probably a good marketing tool for them because they're selling this wine. But again, what I think is quite significant to keep in mind is that the reason why the Austrian Freedom Party, led by Jörg Haider, which is a neo-fascist party, is now the second strongest party in Austria and poised to make a serious run for the chancellorship next time around, gaining 28% of the vote in the last election, is not because Haider overtly identifies with Hitler. He has to distance himself from those symbols. You won't find members of his party, at least in public, wearing swastikas. But when you look at his inner circle, you find Holocaust deniers. You find neo-Nazi terrorists or people who had that affiliations in the past. You find supporters of the Waffen-SS veterans and so forth. But again, the public face they put out is a more moderate one in an attempt to gain voters. But this is significant, and we're finding these tendencies throughout Europe now. In Italy, the National Alliance, led by Gianfranco Fini, who describes himself as a post-fascist, it's gaining 15% of the vote. Many polls show him as the most popular politician. And again, when I cite these figures, 15% or 28%, we have to keep in mind we're talking about parliamentary systems where that percentage of the vote can have a tremendous impact on the political process. And what we find is that even though Le Pen has not gained national power in France, or Haider not yet in Austria, still, they have been able to define the terms of the political debate. They've been able to largely influence the government policy so that the mainstream parties in these countries, in an attempt to defuse the rise of the far right, have adopted their and implemented policies on immigration. But in fact, what they end up doing is conferring legitimacy on the far right, opening the door further to them and helping them gain additional momentum.
We have been talking with Martin Lee. He's author of The Beast Reawakens, Millions Died to End Fascism. It survived to mount a comeback. This is the story of how and why. And as we end on the issue of France, we thought we'd end today's show on a case that's going on in France that looks at the whole issue of Nazis and neo-Nazis, of fascists and neo-fascists. And that is the man who's on trial right now, accused Nazi collaborator Maurice Papon. And we're joined on the phone from Paris by Danielle Singer. He is the Nation magazine's Europe correspondent, and he's been covering that trial and the issues around his case. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Danielle.
Hello.
Well, you've been listening to our conversation with Martin Lee. Let's get right to this case. We touched on it a few days ago, but really only had a minute to begin to discuss it. Tell us who Maurice Papon is and how he fits into this whole discussion.
Yes. I didn't hear the very beginning of your conversation, but I'd like to add, because maybe it was mentioned at the beginning, but I'd like to add something about this revival of Nazism, about one argument which you may have mentioned earlier, but if not, I think it's important. And that is the economic crisis, the nature of the economic crisis, and the failure of the left to provide an alternative. Because if one wants to explain Le Pen and his rise after 1983, without that, I don't think one can understand very much. I don't know whether that was discussed, whether you discussed it earlier, but I think that economic aspect and the failure, that the disappointment with the left, it's something that must figure in it. Because if you have popular discontent, and if you don't have an outlet, if you don't have a rational, progressive solution, you're going to get irrational ones. And that is something to keep in mind when I have followed Le Pen for a very long time, and I could talk about that. But let's leave Le Pen and get down to Papon, and I'm not running away from your question. Now, Maurice Papon, his trial is interesting because it's the trial of the French administration and of what the role that it played of its complicity during the German Nazi occupation of France. Maurice Papon was a civil servant, that is to say a public servant, I think you say in the States, who was not particularly right-wing, was not particularly racist, was not particularly anti-Semitic or anything of the kind. He was simply a time server. He was doing quite well before the war. He is now 87, so he was a fairly young man when the war started, but he already had time to start his career in the administration. And then wartime gave him an opportunity to climb, to rise up the ladder, you see, and he became, by 1942, he went together with his superior with whom he was working in Vichy. The Vichy regime was the pro-German regime in France at the time, and he was appointed then his superior was appointed to be the prefect, that is to say the viceroy, if you want, the representative of the government in the region of Bordeaux, that's claret country, you know, the country of the wine. And he was there as his second in command, as the secretary general of that prefecture. And among other things that he was in charge of were Jewish affairs, and for that reason, he signed the documents about the deportation of the Jews, adult Jews, Jewish children, and so on and so on. Do you want me to go on about his career after?
Yes, I think it's very significant, and especially as we move into the 1960s and the connection between Jews and Algerians.
That's right. Now, this man, as I said earlier, was not particularly anti-Semitic, was not particularly sadistic. He didn't care for his career. He would do anything, you see. And he was obeying orders. And so he was obeying orders. And in that way, he was deporting children to Nazi concentration camps where they died and adults, you see. But he was lucky. At the end of the war in Bordeaux, for all sorts of complicated reasons, because the resistance movement there had inner struggles, people were arrested and so on, spoke, and for that reason that resistance movement in Bordeaux did not have a good representation at the end of the conflict. On the other hand, General de Gaulle, and at the time of the liberation, wanted to have as strong an administration as possible, because that was to stand up to the Americans on one side, to stand up to the communists on the other side, you see, and he needed that. For that reason, Papon, who managed to just to climb from one bandwagon to another, managed somehow to not to be arrested at that time. If he had been arrested at that time, there were lots of people then who were purged and were purged quite strongly. He, having managed to get through the net, if you want, then made as brilliant a career, serving exactly in the same way successive governments. He served the Fourth Republic, which was the regime that followed immediately after the liberation. And when that regime collapsed and General de Gaulle came to office under the Fifth Republic, he served with the same success the next regime. And what is interesting in there, that you mentioned the 60s. In 1961, you see, 1958, that's the moment when de Gaulle comes back to office. He was already appointed prefect of the police of Paris, that is to say, the head of the Paris police in 1958, Papon was. Now, this was the period of the Algerian War. He had already served as a prefect, showing his strong hand in Algeria, which was officially the part of France at the time. Now, you had this great liberation independence movement in Algeria. The struggle was going on in Algeria. We were almost at the end of that war, because this war started of independence started in 1954 and ended in 1962. By 1961, though it was coming to an end, the tension was very great. And as you had in France something like 300,000 Algerians, and most of them were followers of the National Liberation Front, there were attempts here, there was struggle with the police and so on. At that stage, it was declared that you're going to have a curfew and that the Algerians will not be allowed. Actually, they were told they will be advised to, but that was probably the understatement of the year, that they would not be allowed really to go out in the evening. As a protest, the Algerians decided, the FLN, the underground organization, decided to have a mass demonstration in Paris. 30,000 people dared to come out in the street. The French police was determined, was urged by Papon. Papon told them in advance, I'm going to cover you, do whatever you want, and I'm going to cover you. They were prepared for it. They were told about all the policemen who had been killed by the Algerians and so on, and you had a terrible massacre. One doesn't know whether it was 200 or 300 people who were killed on that occasion. Corpses were flowing in the Seine and so on. Why I'm saying it's interesting, this case, because you can see if Monsieur Papon, in his case, Maurice Papon, is going to say, I was not particularly against Jews, that may be quite true. He didn't mind whether it was Jewish blood or Arab blood. It was the question of his career, of him getting on, of him obeying orders, and this is how you advance. Now, that is something that we should keep in mind in that. And to end quickly about his career for you, and I it's a long answer to your question.
That's fine. We just have a few seconds left.
Oh, I see. Then after that, he became a Gaullist deputy. He was minister under the President Giscard d'Estaing. For somebody who renders such services, what a career. If it had not been for the fact that one of the children of a victim had found documents showing that Papon had signed papers about the deportation, and if it had not been for the fact that that crimes committed against humankind are crimes that are forever, you see, he would have gone on.
Well,
he would have been for the best in the best of the world.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Daniel Singer, European correspondent for The Nation magazine, speaking to us from Paris about the trial right now of Maurice Papon. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Our email is democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our director, Leslie George, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our executive producer, Julie Drizin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!